Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So I've got previous notes here from a different film. See how long it can take you to guess what I'm talking about, okay?
Yeah.
2CV.
Ooh, that's...
Mini Club.
Shout.
Ah, James! Jesus Christ! I had to read all of it earlier. I had no idea what I was talking about.
Britain. An ancient kingdom with legends of violence, cruelty, and torment in its blood. Join your hosts, Ross, John, and James, as they bravely tread where few would dare. Witness their journey into the horrific history of British horror. They are... The General Witchfinders.
So, ladies and gentlemen, goblins and ghouls, Merry Christmas wherever you may be. Welcome back to the 41st episode of the General Witchfinders podcast. Part one.
I thought...
Dramatic tension there.
I thought I'd missed my cue then.
No, absolutely not. I'm James in Bournemouth in southern England.
I'm John Pountney in South Wales, which is still in the south of Wales, and it is... Christmas Eve here, everyone.
Yeah, ooh, wait for Santa to arrive. I'm Ross in Dorchester in southern England. This time we watched the BBC Ghost Stories for Christmas, The Stores of Barchester.
With the cathedral bit taken off, for no reason.
The matter began, as far as I'm concerned, in the November of 1932, when I was cataloguing the library of Barchester Cathedral. It was a disappointing collection, and what volumes of value I found were much fallen into decay. My task was scarcely furthered by the unhelpfulness of the librarian, at whose door I found myself bound to place the unhappy confusion that I discovered wherever I turned.
I trust you prosper in your task, Dr. Black.
It's profoundly uninteresting, I'm afraid. I sometimes wonder whether there shouldn't be a tax on authors. Mere poverty seems to be insufficient to deter them from writing. Now, if they had to pay for the privilege...
A great many librarians would be seeking fresh employment, and there'd be far fewer books to catalogue. Have you nearly finished?
With the numbered volumes, yes. In fact, I was just coming to ask you if there was anything else here you thought worth including in my description.
Perhaps I can surprise you.
So, The Stores of Barchester was first broadcast on BBC One at 11 p.m. on December the 24th, 1971. It's based on the story The Stores of Barchester Cathedral from the 1911 collection More Ghost Stories by M.R. James. It was adapted, produced and directed by Lawrence Gordon Clark, who directed every BBC Ghost Stories for Christmas between 71 and 77. And Ross has put, can you name them all, John?
Stalls of Barchester Cathedral.
Bing!
The Treasure of Abbot Thomas.
Yes. Bing!
A Warning to the Curious.
Yes. Bing!
Correct.
The Signalman.
Bing! Yes.
Correct.
Stigma.
Yes. Bing!
Amazing.
The Ice House. Burp, burp. That's not directed by him.
No, apparently not.
Oh. Lost Hearts.
Yeah, bing! And one more.
Brilliant. No, that was all of them, wasn't it?
No, we missed 1975.
What's 1975? What's that one?
The Ash Tree.
Oh, yes, I love The Ash Tree. Yeah.
Not bad going. Well, pretty good going, John.
Yes. I've got to say, that's pretty good going. Right, so...
Pointless, totally pointless knowledge.
It makes you a king amongst our listeners.
The cast of The Stores of Barchester includes several actors better known for their roles in situation comedies or lighter dramas.
According to
Clive, Richard Bucket / Bouquet, Swift as Dr. Black, a character who does not appear in the story and appears as a framing device. As we've mentioned before, he had two appearances in Doctor Who, of which he was not particularly pleased. So it's only fitting that we mention them again. Ross hasn't put this in his script, but go back and listen to our one episode where we talk about the most car crash interview that he ever did. It's incredible. Amazing. Of his appearance in the 2007 Doctor Who Christmas special, Swift declared, "It wasn't until after we'd been filming for 2 weeks that I realised that Mr. Copper is an alien." And having been asked about his appearance in Revelation of the Daleks, 1985, he said,
amazing.
"It was the most bizarre entertainment I have ever been a part of." Amazing. Will Layton as the cathedral librarian, he also appeared in the previously discussed Witchfinders episode, An American Werewolf in London. One of the tramps get killed by David. One of our recurring themes in this podcast.
Yep.
Tramps.
Unfortunately, there's tramps. No tramps in these two episodes that I'm recording tonight.
Robert Hardy is Dr. Haynes. Hardy's birth name was Timothy Sidney Robert Hardy, his nickname being Tim. I don't know why this is important, but, Ross,
it's all facts.
Thanks. He has played British Prime Minister Winston Churchill in 6 separate films and has also twice played Winston Churchill's World War II ally and friend, American President Franklin D. Roosevelt.
No way.
Thelma Barlow appears as Letitia Haynes, famous for her part of Mavis Riley in British soap Coronation Street. Her first episode was transmitted in 1971, but her character only appeared regularly from 1973 when she joined the staff of The Cabin. She remained in the series for 26 years, appearing in nearly 2,000 episodes. And for the benefit of our foreign listeners, we should also point out that she was the bedrock of light entertainment stalwart in this country, Les Dennis.
Yeah, made a whole career out of that.
Made a whole career out of doing an impression of her, which is basically just him, and we'll all do it now. I'm pretty confident on this. And Simon says it of just him going, I don't really know. And that was it. He pretty much did that, and then he got married to Amanda Holden.
Can I ask you something?
Yeah.
You're a comedian, right?
Yeah.
I haven't seen you make a joke for 5 years.
What do you mean?
When you're on telly and stuff, when you're on chat shows or in Big Brother, you're talking to the chickens, but you're moaning about stuff.
That's all you do.
There you go, moaning about stuff. Make a joke about it. Make a joke. I mean, what was that impression you used to do?
Impressions, I did loads.
What was it?
Mavis Riley, Coronation Street.
Do that?
No, I'm not doing that.
Do it.
No!
Go on.
I don't really know!
That's great.
Yeah, I know. It is good, yeah.
But did she ever even say that line in Cora?
I don't think so.
That's the thing, that's like Beam Me Up Scotty is famous never lying.
Play it again, Sam.
All yes.
That kind of stuff.
And I don't really know. She probably never said it, did she?
No, but it'll probably come up again at some point in this episode.
She turned into Mavis Wilton later on, didn't she?
Yeah, originally, where I cribbed this all from, was referring to her as Mavis Wilton. No one called him Mavis Wilton.
Well, when she was married to Derek Wilton, with he had a paperclip on top of his Vauxhall Corsa.
Why?
He was just worked for a stationery company.
Well, you mean like a giant one rather than just
a giant one, not a tiny,
just a normal one, not on the aerial or anything. Right. Anyway, right. So,
a tiny one, a normal size paperclip.
Right. So, the next one, Ross, I must admit that I made exactly the same error as you here.
Yeah.
Harold Bennett appears as Archdeacon Pulteney.
Yeah.
Not Pulteney, as I thought it was, and Ross thought it was too. And I wrote down excitedly Archdeacon Pulteney and underlined
it. Well, I do always wonder, because obviously the Pulteney Bridge is in Bath, which is famously in Bath. And I always wonder if we're somehow related
I reckon.
Yeah.
A lot of these gotta be.
But in London, Llundain, to our Welsh language listeners, there is a Pountney Street, which is the correct spelling, because there was a Lord Mayor of London who was called Pountney in the 13th century.
Oh, nice.
And that is all a true fact.
Do you know what Pountney means?
Nice.
Is that something to do with chickens?
Well, originally, my dad's company was called Pountney's Poultry. He thinks that it's something to do with DuPont, as in it was like a Welsh, not a Welsh.
Norman.
Fuck, I got Welsh on the brain. Yeah, it's like a Norman French thing.
Interesting.
Yeah, so it's a very old name, though.
Great. So, Pulteney / Pulteney.
Yeah.
He is best known as the lecherous octogenarian young Mr. Grace in the long-running sitcom series Are You Being Served, with an absolutely tremendous theme tune.
Also starring Wendy Richards, wasn't it?
Going up. Oh, she is the worst wanker,
yeah,
isn't
of
she?
Them all.
He's the worst wanker of them all, as we know. And then apparently, and I didn't know this, that Bennett had a career as an architect and only became an actor when he retired.
And it does seem like his only acting is just being an old man and not saying anything.
Good morning, young
Mr.
whatever he says.
Right, so Eric Chitty appears as the priest seen in Doctor Who, the deadly assassin, as Engin, the Time Lord coordinator of the Matrix.
Elgin. I think it's Elgin.
Ross has put Engin.
Yeah. Oh, it might be Engin.
Anyway, well,
according to the TARDIS wiki, it was Engin.
I think there might be an Elgin and an Engin, or maybe I'm thinking of the Engin marbles. I don't know what. So who was the... So the little nerdy man who's like the verger or something, is he known? Because he steals the show, doesn't he?
Not that I took any notes on, unfortunately.
Absolutely thoroughly researched ever, this podcast.
Yeah, yeah. These are the ones I thought people might actually have heard of any of the things they've done.
And as mentioned, Ross has just put David Pugh as John and Ambrose Coghill as museum curator.
Yes.
The adaptation was filmed on location in Norwich Cathedral and the surrounding close, one of two great British locations that we're going to see in this and our New Year's Eve episode.
I thought it was
church-themed location.
Yeah, I really thought it was Salisbury when I was looking at it.
Very similar. They're built on similar lines, though, Ross, aren't they? You know that. Anyway, high church, etc. Right, so unusually for a BBC television drama of the 1970s, both interior and exteriors in the stalls of Barchester were originated on 16mm film, as opposed to the standard studio videotape for interiors. And my God, you can tell. And that's part of what makes it so good.
Were any Doctor Who's filmed in a similar way, John?
I think only Spearhead from Space was shot entirely on 16mm film, which is why it transferred to Blu-ray so well.
Yeah, you're getting all the hits tonight, guys.
I think it's a real shame that the colours in this one, and particularly the episode that we're going to do next week for Christmas Day.
New Year's Eve.
Even though Christmas Day is tomorrow. Oh, no, Christmas Eve. Yeah, okay.
New Year's Eve.
New Year's Eve. For fuck's sake. Right, so the one we're doing...
It's Christmas Eve. We're a bit drunk. We've been out caroling, haven't we?
We're waiting for the chimes of midnight for Christmas Day so I can open my first present.
Yeah.
So a week tonight, on New Year's Eve, we're not going out to celebrate with our friends. We're staying in to watch what's it called? It's Treasure of Abbott Thomas.
Yes, we are, yeah.
The colours on the Treasure of Abbott Thomas Brilliant. Are very washed out, aren't they? And I wish they could do something to kind of bring that back a little bit. Yeah. It looks a bit...
Maybe we should get the colourisation team who did the Daleks.
Well, yeah, they've just left it. Oh, God, did you watch the Daleks?
It was awful.
It was really terrible.
So, it was so weirdly dumb. Like,
the first half hour, I was like, God, this is really good. And then it got to this mad Jeff Wayne jazzy interlude. Yeah. And it was just like they'd thrown the edit suite at the wall and just...
And they kept doing like these flat cover-up cuts. They kept doing flashbacks to things that happened like 2 seconds ago.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, very, very strange
very weird.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Yes. But
I still watched it all.
Yeah, I watched it. Well done to everyone involved.
Yes, exactly. But it was really, really hard. But it was insane. It was like he was having some kind of like fever. It was
Dalek fever dream. Yeah. I do think the colours of the Dalek control room, especially the little Dalek dials, did look especially good, though. A bit like what's the program called? Not Cracker Jack.
Chock-a-Block.
Chock-a-Block, yeah. Chock-a-Block, Chock-a-Block. It looked like the machinery in Chock-a-Block, didn't it?
Yes,
when they used to put the big videotape into them.
Chocker girl checking in.
And there was, but I also, when there was a bit of colorization when Barbara was up against like the wall when they first see the Dalek, and I was thinking, doing the reflection, colorizing the reflection on this must be really fucking hard to do that.
Yeah, you could have just made the wall silver, couldn't you? Rather than like,
Of course, James watched it a few times, didn't you, James?
Oh, I've no idea what you're talking about.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So we have met Dr. Black before, haven't we? But
have we?
It's after this. Yeah, we meet Dr. Black in Warning to the Curious.
I have no memory of that at all.
No,
have we reviewed a Warning
we have
to
done,
the Curious?
We have done a Warning to the Curious. Oh yes. I didn't realise he was playing the same character.
So he's playing the same character.
That's
yes,
when he does the Benny Hill sort of. Running around, being...
following that. Yeah. So we've met him before, but in this is 1932, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I cannot remember if the other episode is set before this, which means that, thankfully, he survives his interlude with William Agar. That's watching the start of this, that's all I thought. This is set in the 20s, 30s, and then they say it's 1932... because it's 50 years since the box has been posited by Letitia, his sister. And then I thought, oh, does that mean he survived? Because he gets on the train at the end.
Mm.
And the guy, as he gets on the train, says, oh, sorry, sir, I thought I saw someone else get on the carriage with you there, or words dun, dun,
dun.
For that.
No, it doesn't say when it was set. But we were set in the Depression, wasn't it?
It was set in the Depression, but I don't know if it wasn't the 20s. So I hope that Dr. Black survived that traumatic interlude in his life.
Mm.
He went on holiday. Peter Vaughan was there. Peter Vaughan dug up a crown. He helped him return the crown. But then it's suggested that he inherited the ghost of William Agar, who is the vengeful spirit coming to sort out... Well, he no does digging. Sort out Peter Vaughan. No digging here. So then we have... So basically what I think the start of this film is the dream scenario for M.R. James, the author, is that he goes and he researches some old books in a musty old library. And this...
Lovely.
This is known to be the life that M.R. James was wanted and did a lot of stuff where he...
Mm.
Personally did translate a lot of incredible stuff that hadn't been translated before. He, as a child, he would write to Queen Victoria.
Really?
And was ticked off for doing so. And he became quite obsessed, I think, with Queen Victoria as a child. This is all details that I've gleaned from the M.R. James podcast that I used to listen to. They haven't done a episode since July now.
Well, is that because they run out of things to talk about?
Well, no, they started doing a new sequence of books, but then it just seemed to stop, which is very sad. But I think that's the framework for this story is basically M.R. James thinking, what would be my perfect day out? It would be to go to a very musty old library somewhere, find some papers, and then find a story hidden within those papers, which the production designer has kind of sprinkled with what looks like dried poster paint.
Yeah, over the top, yeah.
I don't know if you can get paint like that anymore, but poster paint when I was in infant school wasn't a disc. It was like powder.
Yeah, and you had those pots, which you sort of screwed a thing on, which you stuck the paintbrush into. I can smell it now. The smell
of
powder
paint.
Yes,
I can smell it. Yeah. Yes. And it just looks like that, basically, doesn't it? Sprinkled into the cask.
So it's essentially there was a very nice shot of him of Clyde Swift walking up the corridor.
Yes,
and it was put at that angle, so it looks like he's sort of like going up a hill but getting smaller, and the perspective is very nice. And
yes,
yeah, I think this was the first one they did after. Whistle I Come To You, wasn't it? This is like when it actually became like the Ghost Stories of Christmas. And I think this is pretty much the one which established what these things are actually going to be like, isn't it?
Well, it's Lawrence Gordon Clark is a kind of unheralded TV genius with these because I think they're so well directed. I've seen that Mark Gatiss has got a new one coming out for this Christmas now, which I'm very excited about.
For tonight.
Oh, tonight, yes.
It's on tonight, of course. So Mark Gatiss, so we'll probably watch it after we finish here, guys, and we'll let you know what that's like.
Oh, of course.
But sometime
in January.
Yeah, but we probably won't talk about it on New Year's Eve, even though we would have watched it.
No, said we'll talk about it in January for reasons.
Yeah, we'll keep it back.
So, but that one, I do know, took them only 4 days to shoot.
Really?
Which is absolutely mental. And did these in such a short amount of time. But to make something look so good, which you've basically got no time to spend over it at all, is very, very impressive.
But when you probably got Kit Harington, you couldn't afford them for more than 4 days, I imagine.
No, I mean, that's the thing. People probably do a lot of favours for people like Mark Gatiss, don't they? Because they're thoroughly nice chaps. And they say, come and take part in my... mummy story. So I'm very much looking forward to that because it's a good story as well. Conan Doyle. Anyway.
Yes.
So back to this. It does look good, doesn't it? Because it's all on 16mm film.
It does. It does. And that's the joy of this, we'll get this out of the way really early on, is the use of darkness and what might be.
Yes.
The whole thing of dark houses at night. And what may be out there in the dark and the shadow is used incredibly effectively in this.
Yes.
In both the churches And I was thinking, I was watching it, is it obviously at the time, the 1970s, but it does feel kind of quintessentially British.
The 3 day week.
That dark winter's night. Yeah. And that, you know, that winter, like what that, like we're in the middle of right now.
Yeah.
Know, dark by quarter to five in the evening. And it's just the feel of it all. And it really, for me, was so beautifully atmospheric. And
it's very, very atmospheric.
And there's proper blacks in it as well, which modern televisions can't deal with. It just, they try and do something with the black. It ends up getting weird, like artifacts
looks,
and stuff.
Yeah, it looks very pixelated. Mm. For me, this story is about like an obsessive compulsive disorder. And I think that's the subtext with I must be firm. It's this idea that you can't get out of your head. And I think that is something really that M.R. James potentially suffered from himself. If we looked at it, if we looked at him from a kind of modern prism, you know, he was obsessed with Queen Victoria and he wrote these letters to Queen Victoria when he was a child and he was ticked off by, you know, the head of Eton. So it's, was it Eton he went to or the other one? Eton and King's.
He ended up being one of the he taught at Harrow, didn't he, towards the end of his life, I seem to remember from that.
I think it's Eton, James, but I can't remember.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but he
one
was
of the
top,
big private
yeah,
schools,
he was so. Toppermost of the poppermost of scholars of that age. But I do think that his personality had this obsessive compulsive thing which was hidden away. And I've only learnt about through other kind of scholarly research into his life. But I think this story is very much about someone who debates whether they are, as it's said in the scripts, it's in the script it mentions incipient decay of the brain. And he says, either I've got incipient decay of the brain or I am hearing these voices. But obviously that's the duality of madness or an obsessive compulsive thing, isn't it? Because it's like, I can't tell the difference. I'm here all alone. And, you know, Letitia's gone and blah, 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 blah. So for me, I think that's what this is about. And I think it's really, really good. And I think that, I think the story is also really, really strong.
So essentially what the story is.
Yeah.
So Dr. Black has found the box of papers belonging to
The Archdeacon Haynes.
Yeah, Haynes.
Right.
Yes.
Now, Ross, you should just point out, before you crack into that, the joy of the fact that Clive Swift says to the librarian, like, I don't think there's anything really interesting here.
Yes.
And the librarian drops a few morsels in front of him. He's interested in R.D. Allington's mathematical tract, which I thought sounded like a vaguely dirty proposal. But he's not interested. But then he finally says, oh, but you might be interested in this, which isn't all that. And that's always such a great way in, isn't it, to go but maybe you might be interested in this, which is off the books, and it's this locked box.
Some mute inglorious Milton, perhaps. Canon Marcel's annotation to the Epistle of the Thessalonians, no? Professor R.D. Allington's mathematical tract.
I think not.
Well, Cyrus, of course.
Cyrus?
An epic poem in eight cantos, product of a country clergyman's leisure. I wonder if he read it to his parishioners.
I expect he did.
Oh, what's this? I don't remember. Oh. Yes, of course, I'd completely forgotten.
Papers of the Venerable Archdeacon Haynes, bequeathed in 1894 by his sister Letitia Haynes.
Haynes? Now, I know that name. I read something about it quite recently.
Our old dean said the box should never have been accepted by the library. He kept it locked up in the deanery. He said it never would be opened while he was in charge.
Strange. I've wanted to know what was in that box for years. You'd better have a look at it.
Yes, and and essentially, he says this wasn't allowed to be opened within a certain amount of time. And it's implied, and I thought it was quite interesting, there's implied that there's some kind of salacious like scandal around it.
Yes.
And it's like basically, you could look at it, but if you find something quite dodgy in here, can I trust you not to publish this? And I thought, wow, that's amazing, isn't it?
It's good. It's a good start. Yeah, yeah. And then we find out, he's like, oh, I don't know much about Archdeacon Haynes. And then he says, oh, the only thing that I could find was that there's an obituary in a gentleman's magazine. Mm-hmm. And I put, what, Razzle or Escort? When I think gentleman's magazine, that's obviously my teenage boy mind. That's immediately what it goes to.
But that made me think of Gentleman's Relish.
And that as well, which also sounds vaguely rude. Yeah. But anyway, he decides that he's, Clive Swift, Mr. Black decides that he's going to read. So having opened up the box, he begins to read the story, which is then the story that we see, the Stalls of Barchester, the story of Archdeacon Haynes and what happens. So Ross, carry
and
on.
And his clip-cloppy shoes.
His clip-cloppy shoes. Which,
and his very clip-cloppy shoes.
Yeah, which when you're watching on YouTube with the closed captions on, every time he walks past, it says sound of applause. So
is it really?
Yeah. So it's picking up the clip-cloppy shoes is clapping.
Cleaver, you can drop in the sound of those clip-cloppy shoes now.
Right now.
There we go.
Great, because I love the sound. When I know I'm watching something really wholesome and comforting, it's either Plague of the Zombies with the clip-cloppy shoes in that, or it's this with the clip-cloppy shoes in this. And I ponder, what are the clip-cloppy shoes made of? Are they wooden underneath?
Or, I don't know, or still stoke up. I think we were discussing maybe they were Roy Castle-esque
tap dance shoes, yeah.
Because my shoes don't clip-clop. Whatever shoes I wear, they don't clip-clop.
Yeah, it's all trainers nowadays,
aren't
it?
Yeah, they hardly make a sound. Whereas these are very precise Victorian shoes.
Have you ever
had
shoes resold?
No.
Yeah, so I've done that.
This is what people tune in for. have you ever sought out the services of a cobbler listener? Have you ever been involved in Rumpelstiltskin?
Moronic twaddle.
But you know, they would have put like metal on their shoes to stop them wearing out, because you would have to those shoes.
So you
have to
think
last
it
a long
would
time.
Be metal soles? Yeah. I thought wood.
I think they would have had like metal bits on them to stop them wearing out.
Oh, like little tacks.
Yeah, like half moon bits at the heel and stuff.
Oh,
like that.
Okay, interesting.
We can look at, so maybe we could have some shoe cobbling experts on there. Why do cobblers have the little robots? Advertising their ways.
Yeah. Slowly hammering something.
But no one else. There's no other.
Yeah. Fishmongers don't have a man with a fish, do they?
They're chopping up.
Which is.
Yeah. That'll be anyway. A Doctor Who villain within the next series.
Paging Russell now.
Yeah.
So we start off with quite choppy bits of. The creation of an atmosphere, which basically describes that Robert Hardy's character is waiting for his elderly boss, who is the Archdeacon, to snuff it.
Yes.
But he keeps on going. So Letitia's sister, who is Thelma Barlow, mentions that there's this infection in town, and he's like, oh, unfortunately, he hasn't touched the Archdeacon. Crossed. And then he's there and he's waving. And then there's a scene where they're toasting the good health of the Archdeacon with about five blokes.
Years are passing.
Yeah. And then a few scenes later, there's only three blokes left. So, but then we get we go into the clever setup and exposition, I've said, because I think it's done quite well, because it's this choppy kind of thing. And then we do we see him pushed down the stairs? Or does he fall at that point?
He falls. But the way they frame it and shoot it, you get the feeling that you're maybe not seeing everything.
Mm.
Jane Lee, who is the Archdeacon's maid, kind of watches him fall, observes him, and then allows several beats to pass before screaming.
Yeah.
And it's a very good scream, isn't it?
Oh, hold on. It's a fantastic scream, yeah.
Yeah. And then they're talking about there's a missing stair rod. So
stair rod, that's right.
Which made the stair, the carpet.
Which so far is pretty much what the story... I mean, this really is quite this sticks to the story quite well. I mean, a lot of the lines are lifted directly from the story, and I think it's all the stronger for that. Next week, when we do the Treasure of Abbot Thomas, that one deviates quite substantially from the story, and we'll debate that, I'm sure, next week on New Year's Eve.
Yes.
But I think it was, I think Robert Hardy did an expert masterclass in looking pissed off.
Yes, and very Victorian.
Yes,
those mutton chops are superb that he's sporting.
Yeah.
Magnificent.
And a very yellow kind of base coat of foundation on his face, which is quite strange. So my notes are very poor for this. So I've written duty in capital letters, Victorian man of substance, and that is Archdeacon Haynes at this part in the story, isn't it? Because he's basically... they make a... M.R. James makes a big fuss in the story, the written story, about how he's trying to get the kind of finances of the church back on an even keel.
Right,
because the previous Archdeacon Pulteney wasn't very good at looking after stuff like that.
Yes.
With this goes quite quickly and more into the ghost story stuff, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And it gets quite stone tapey in terms of...
Mm.
You hear voices. What you're hearing is psychic recordings rather than his incipient decay of the brain.
But it's interesting, though, because it's not the ghost of the dead archdeacon who's haunting him. Mm. So he just... So essentially, there's a... In where the... when he gets the job of the archdeacon who dies, so he now becomes the archdeacon.
He inherits the mantle.
And he's got, in the area of the church where he sits, and is it the pulpit? Would you say that's a pulpit? I don't know.
It's not a pulpit. Underneath his seats is what's called misericords, but I don't know what his... I'd say it's a throne.
Yeah.
The archdeacon's throne.
Mm. Yeah. So they've got two like hand rests, which... It doesn't look out of place, but it is very clear that he does sit holding these two carved arms of the throne.
So one is a black cat, isn't it?
Yes.
And one,
and the other is a hooded man or a hooded skull. Yes.
So in the story, I think there's three carvings. So this dispenses with one. But in the story, he's called the King of Terrors, which I think is a great title.
Whoa, that's good.
Yeah, which I think would be my autobiography title.
Yeah, hey, note that down.
John Pountney, King of Terrors. But on the cover, it wouldn't be a picture of me. It would be a picture of Tosh Lines from TV's The Bill.
The Bill.
Yeah, as long as you had a picture of him with all his kids on the back cover.
The man who loved too much, remember?
Mm-hmm. So essentially, there's a point where he's Robert Hardy is kind of, he's been kept awake a bit by hearing, like, he kind of talks about, like,
and haven't we all,
the unsettled sort of noises. He feels like whenever he's not outside of his room, it all sounds like it's busy, there's stuff going on, but whenever he goes out there, it's silent. And I thought that was gonna make, and I've heard people just talk about the haunted places like that, where it feels like when you go into the room, it's just as if there was lots of stuff going on until you walked in there, and then it just...
Movement without sound.
That's it, exactly.
Mm. Yes.
I often wake up and...
Here we go.
And have the feeling as if there was a lot of noise, and then it was suddenly, like, gone silent.
Yes.
And that's that kind of feeling, I imagine.
I get that. I think that's when you hold yourself rigid in your sleep for some reason. And then you wake up. So a couple of weeks ago, I had some prawn crisps.
And when is this a chapter in the King of Terror?
Yeah. When I looked at the ingredients on the prawn crisps, it actually had crustaceans in.
Oh, okay.
And because I suffer from IBS, I thought, this might be a fuck up.
Yeah.
And basically that night I woke up thinking, what the fuck is that noise outside? I walked around the house for an hour until I realised that it was sound in my ear.
Right.
Which was a very strange experience, which since has subsided, but it sounded like machinery outside. But it was actually, I think it was actually brought on due to the vagus nerve going from my bowel to my my cranium. And I think it was brought on by these dried crustaceans.
Or you became aware that you're actually a cyborg and... it was sort of the way this was coming through, but luckily the filter kicked back in. So
but
you couldn't
I,
hear it.
This is the duality of Archdeacon Haynes, isn't it? He doesn't know, have I eaten crisps with real crustaceans in,
yeah,
or is it actually a ghost who in the story is described as having wet lips, which is quite creepy in itself, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, yeah, carry on, Cleves.
I can't remember where we got to.
Well, in short, you know, for a bit of brevity's sake, what we get established very quickly is quite obvious that...
he's got the willies.
Yes, that Haynes... A.K.A. Robert Hardy, Hayes, A.K.A. Robert Hardy.
No, it is Haynes.
It is Haynes. I was right.
The first one. Oh, like the Haynes Motor Museum.
Like the Haynes Manual. Yeah. Right. So what we learn is that Archdeacon Haynes has clearly paid the maid to basically bring about the previous Archdeacon's demise.
Yes.
And even though we learn that he is the absolute best fit for the job, he does a great, as John said, you know, the previous Archdeacon did not do a good job on the finances, but we're told that Robert Hardy, he's absolutely on it, and things start, you know, things are going very, very well. But first of all, he looks across at the maid during one service and he's like, it's quite freaky and quite weird. And then we kind of see that the more and more time that he's spending alone, his sister, who's, I don't really know. Whatever her name is.
Letitia.
Yeah.
You know,
Mavis.
Letitia, thank you. Letitia keeps going, oh, I'm going to go away to go to Brighton to visit relatives, thus leaving him in the manse, in the church.
Good
home.
Use of the word manse, James. Thank the you. Old manse.
Thank you. The old. Thank you. Right. So, thus leaving him alone, and at this point, as we just said, Stone Tape-esque, he begins to be haunted, and this is where the coolness of both the darkness of them shooting it on film and the sound, as we were just talking about, all starts to come into play. He hears sounds. He hears voices. He keeps seeing a black cat, which is one of the things carved into the aforementioned throne.
And at one point, he's got his hand on the handrest, and he feels like fur. You can feel the fur.
Looks like it's come alive. And the thing that I put down is that, weirdly enough, for me, you know, I've already said about, you know, the darkness of England and sort of English winters. And what I just put down is my Aunt Sylvia's house. Now, my Aunt Sylvia, who's my mum's eldest sister,
amazing.
She lived in a mid-terrace, turn of the century house. Not an old, but my God, there was something weird and spooky about that house. And they always said it was haunted. And all I can tell you is, when you'd go upstairs, the only bathroom was upstairs. You'd go up, you know, quite steep steps onto the darkness in and around that landing was always almost tangible for me as a kid.
Palpable.
And those shots when Robert, it was when Robert Hardy was looking off into the darkness. I was like, this reminds me of my Aunt Sil's house.
Mm.
And so
Danny Robbins
really,
down
really
there,
working
James,
for
think,
me.
Don't we?
We do. We do.
Oh yeah, I was thinking that because a point. When he's scared of getting up, he said, when he left his watch downstairs and he was scared to go downstairs. And I was thinking, I can't remember the last time I was scared to walk around in the dark. But when you're a kid...
Was it when you thought Fred West was in your bathroom?
Oh, he's trying to put his hands through the letterbox. Sorry. That was my dream I had.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But when I was a kid, I was so scared of the dark. I would like be busting to go to the toilet, but I would not get out of bed. Well,
for me, the line that sums this up is, I find that I absolutely shrink from the dark season.
Mm.
And whenever it gets to fucking October for me and the clocks are about to bust a change again, I think, what fucking idiot thought up this rule that we have to make it darker just so someone in Scotland can have a little bit of daylight when they're farming, so the rest of the country has it dark at bloody 4 o'clock? Because it should be 5 o'clock, which is kind of livable. But it's sunset now, is it like 3 minutes past 4? And I'm just like,
great.
For fuck's sake. I to be honest, I identify with our man here. I think the old guy was hanging around too much. You know, old people, a bit like Boris Johnson, you know, they've had their time, old people. It's time to get rid of them.
You didn't call Dave Lee, did you?
I killed Dave Lee Travis. it's a very good evocation of mental illness through, you know, what we'd call these days like seasonal affective disorder or something, isn't it? It is like this guy spends too much time on his own. He's in the fucking dark. He sits in this throne and he thinks the cat's come to life. A bit, you know, later on you see the skull of the King of Terrors, don't you? Where, which is really good. We haven't mentioned the Verger or whatever he is yet. Matthew, who is this slimy little creep who creeps up behind him. With a little...
He makes him jump, and there's such a good look on Robert Hardy's face.
Yeah. Yes. He's got, like, what we call a five-a-side moustache. and he's just... But he steals. A bit like Arnold the Boots in Warning to the Curious. This guy does steal it for me because he's so good at this kind of oleaginous, creepy kind of, you know...
That's a great part when he said, I'm glad to see you. I just wanted to talk to so-and-so who I saw you walking up here with. And he's like, I wasn't walking with you. And then you can see him sort of walk off and sort of look to see where. Yeah. And it's very similar to Warning to the Curious when people are seeing another figure walking with with Peter Vaughan and stuff.
That sequence is basically shot for shot a remake of Cat People. Where the lady is trying to catch the bus and she hears footsteps behind her. It's almost exactly the same. It's cribbed, like, not shot for shot, but it's like... But fair play to, what's his name now, the director? Alexander Graham Bell. Alexander Gordon...
Lawrence Gordon Clark.
Lawrence Gordon Clark. Fair play to him. Like, I think it's... It's interesting now because everything now is so accessible. I think when someone cribbed a scene like that from a film in the past, it was very obvious that not everyone was going to know what you'd ripped off. So you kind of got away with it. Whereas now, everyone has seen all those films umpteen times because they're at your fingertips. But I think back in the 70s, it was kind of... It was almost a nod and a wink to people that knew what you were kind of referencing, and I think it's quite clever for that.
So what? There's a really good bit where they go to the piece of land where the wood which was cut down to make the carvings
now,
as well.
Yes, the hanging oak.
Now, hold on. Again, now for me, this was the best bit, and this is what really... I was enjoying it anyway, but this, bearing in mind that we kind of... You know, one of our touchstones on this podcast has been folk horror. And this was the most amazingly folk horror bit. It was so much going on in about 3 minutes. It was superb.
Yeah.
So Haynes decides, we're told, and we're going to coming back to this again on our New Year's Eve edition, that he's a rational man. Despite being a man of faith, we're also told that he's a rational man. And he decides that he wants to get to the bottom of it. And we see that he's gone for a walk out into the countryside with... whoever that guy is, kind of like a man, you know, another guy from the local area, man, you know.
He's probably an antiquarian, you know, of some
aged gent, and... antiquarian of some, who kind of gives him the rundown on the local area.
Yeah.
And first of all, he says, those carvings in the church, who did them? They're very unusual. And we're told that it was made by Austin the Twiceborn.
Yeah.
Because we're told that, which is great. Straight away, and we're told that what he had the power of foresight, which is awesome. Yeah. And what's so great about this is that itself could be in its own story. But we're just had foresight. What happens with it? You'll never know. It's awesome. But we're told that, you know, so that was his skill, and that he made them. And he then goes, "Oh look, you know, in fact, even though it's a Christian church, those carvings were made from wood from this wood." And this wood would have been the site of pagan rituals and the old religion from before the time of Christ. And I was like, this is great. This is what I'm, this is what. And then he says, for example, over here, and points to, you know, what looks like a burial mound, but we're then told it's the hanging oak. He says, because when they excavated it, they found like human bodies in between. And so, you know, they therefore think that, this tree was used to hang people, you know, criminals, wrongdoers, and during those sort of pagan pre-Christian times. And I've just written down maximum folk horror.
Yes.
Yes.
Superb.
Just a kind of side plug for another podcast I do called Dark Darcy. No.
But here we go.
We went to a church near here, which has got Norman carvings along the roof. And it's one of the few places in England where there's a Sheilinigig.
Sheilinigig, yes.
And there's two of them on there. So so this is a Christian church, but there's all these pagan carvings on there. So a Sheilinigig is basically a massive vulva on there. And there's all these other like people copulating and all this kind of stuff. But they're all carved into the ceiling of the church.
A lot
of them have been defaced because when as years went on, so when some of the sort of Victorians got a bit like prudish about these things being in the church, they kind of sort of chopped off the phalluses and stuff. Mm. But it's just so interesting.
The Reformation as well. They got rid of a lot of stuff in the Reformation as well. Whitewashed a lot of stuff like that.
But it's so interesting, like so-called Christian churches would have had pagan, and like when we went to Salisbury Cathedral or Winchester Cathedral, one of the two, they were just saying there's all of these faces, and like some of them's got like faces, like people with two faces, like one looking forwards, one looking back, and all these kind of very bizarre, semi kind of like monstrous sort of carvings all put around these places because they just wanted to fill it up with stuff. And
it's what I find about it very. What I find fascinating about M.R. James is that he was very, very, very devoutly Christian, but he did fill his stories with all of this stuff, which is quite remarkable. And there's some stories actually that we should potentially review at some point, that An Evening's Entertainment is one where it's a story that is like a fireside story that's told by a grandmother to her grandchildren, but that incorporates stories of like druidism and stuff, and like a big figure on the hillside. And I think it's super interesting how, as a Christian guy who was very, very religious, he would incorporate this stuff into his stories and also write these really quite terrifying and macabre and grotesque stories. And I think that is part of Christianity itself. In when you think of the kind of British end of Christianity, it was about kind of living cheek by jowl with kind of pagan mythology and imagery, green men and all this stuff, which you do see in a lot of Christian churches, don't you? Which is mental. Kilpeck as well, which is not far from here in Herefordshire. That's another one, Cleves, where it's very kind of Sheilinigigs and all that kind of stuff. Right, so where are we up to with this story now?
So we've
done the Killing Oak, haven't we?
Yeah. And as you said, the last line from that part is, as far as I know, the old customs have died.
Which is a good line to end that scene on. Yeah.
And then from that point on, we're told that things begin to escalate. We see things beginning to escalate. First of all, we have the redux of, you know, whereas before he was during a church service, he thought, you know, with his hand on the cat carving, it became a real cat. On the other side, he has his hand on the other side, and then he, oh my God, it's a hooded skull. And we see everyone looking at him like, oh, is this guy freaking out? And all the rest of it. At one point, when he's going around.
And I love how these all done silent as well.
Yes,
no sound, fantastically no sound. He has like the creepy hand touch his back.
Oh, yeah.
That made me think of Doom Lord from the Eagle. Do you remember Doom Lord?
Yes.
Doom Lord.
Yeah,
yeah,
very
yeah,
similar,
yeah,
Ross.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
That's one for the teenagers.
It was a comic strip, which was like photographs, wasn't it?
Yes.
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 Yeah, it was fantastic. But yeah, it looked like a Doom Lord glove. So being touched on the shoulder.
It did. So in short, this builds up to a climax, and we also see from, you know, while Clive Swift is reading his notes, and he's like, I can't escape this. He's like, I could go with I don't really know, Thelma or whatever, I could go with my sister and escape it, but I can't. And I thought that was really interesting. I mean, as John, you were saying earlier about, you know, M.R. James being an obsessive. And it's like he can't let go of this thing. He feels like he's in the thrall of it, which I think, if anything, that's the scariest thing.
Why do you think he keeps writing, "I must be firm"? What do you think that... What? Do you think that's related to that?
I think it's that, once again, it's that, it's the dream of rationality, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's
that
if I continue to be rational, if I continue to stick to the to these principles, I can't go wrong.
Mm.
And so, but, you know, I must not waver from them.
It's again, a, like me, a that's Victorian really mindset, isn't it? It's just like...
Yes.
Yeah. Totally.
But once again, that dream, and you know, one of two stories that we're seeing where it's like, oh, men of faith, but also men of reason. Mm. And it's that, you know, the tension there was really, really palpable and really good.
Sorry, there's a great bit when he goes to bed, but he says to his servant...
John.
John. No, come up to my bedroom because I'm going to need to give you a letter to... I need posting. Yeah. And you hear that's from it. Outside the door. And he says, come in, and the door opens. And then...
No, he says, shall I come in now?
Yeah. And then the door opens and there's no one there. Yeah, it's fantastic.
And that is the climax, isn't it? Is that he pretty then much, ventures out on...
He looks for what he thinks might be... Well, I don't know if he knows what he thinks he's even looking for at that point, because I wouldn't fucking go looking.
But he also asks Johnny, because do we have a cat in the kitchen?
Yes. Because.
And I thought that was interesting, because I just assumed that it was a cat that which lived in the house, which he kept seeing, but it was no cat there at all.
No. In the story, the admission is there is no kitchen cat, and it's all about, you know, what is this spirit? What is he being haunted by? Is it multiple things? Is it a kind of, is it vengeance from, I mean, what's interesting actually, and I've never thought of it like this, it's like, it's vengeance from the point of a Christian man, Archdeacon Pulteney, but he's doing it in quite an unchristian way, isn't he?
I never thought it was him. I felt it was his own guilt which was haunting him. So rather than...
Yes, I think you're right, because the way that when we see Ambrose Bierce or whoever it is at the end, it's explained that it is it's the tree.
The curse.
Yeah. Yes, you are right, Cleves. I've totally misread this story for about 7 years.
So he essentially goes to the top of the stairs.
Yes.
And there's an amazing sort of...
Sequence.
Yeah, he kind of gets enveloped by...
Yes.
Like a hooded...
A cloak.
A cloaked figure, and then you just hear him like a take a breath, and then Doom Lord comes back and scratches his face, and then he falls down the stairs,
disfiguring him, we're told, and then he then dies as the last Archdeacon.
It's a great montage of shots where it's almost done in as stills, because it's so kind of, but then the actual crash of him falling down the stairs is quite a jolt, isn't it? And then he folds over and you see his face has been scratched. Or as we say in Wales, scrammed.
Ooh.
And then he's dead. And you're just like, oh.
Yes.
Hecky mokey, as my grandmother would say.
And our postscript to this is that Clive Swift, Mr. Black, decides that he's like, oh, well, this is intriguing, and decides to go and have a look at the church for himself.
Yes.
Only to find that the offending chair, the wooden carvings are gone.
Yes.
And he's then told, well, you might want to go and look in the church museum, which is where we put all of this stuff. And then he goes into and speaks to, as John says, the guy who runs, he works at the church museum, who says, I've only ever heard of these pieces. They're long, you know, they're gone now. But what we did find was this letter, which was inside the carving, that basically says, you know, I carved these from the hanging tree, and anyone who touches these, who is guilty or has some guilt, will, you know, justice will be meted out to them.
Yeah.
And oh, wow.
The twice born, wasn't it?
Yes, indeed. So it's kind of like, you know, that kind of ties it all up very neatly. And Clive Swift says, well, what happened to them? And he says, well, the man who took ownership of them, they freaked out his kids so much he burnt them.
Mm-hmm.
So they've been destroyed. And then that is pretty much the last line. However, it finishes with Clive Swift sort of walking away, and they have a black and white cat there. And what I've written is, couldn't they have just found a black cat?
Yeah, yeah.
I know it's really difficult to wrangle a cat.
Or have the cat which I used earlier. the actual cat. Exactly,
because I thought surely that would have been the lovely wink at the end, is that, you know, he walks past the black cat.
Yeah.
It's still there. But no, they just have a black and white cat. End. Finn. Yes. But fantastic.
Very good, yes. Okay, what was Christmas number one in 1971?
71?
When this film was released.
It's not Johnny Mathis.
It's not
a Christmas record.
It's not a famous Christmas record, but it is a famous comedy record.
Oh, go on.
Ernie, the fastest.
The fastest milkman in the West.
Yes, was number one in 1971. You don't hear that on any
Benny Hill.
Yeah, many Christmas or compilation Ernie. Albums, do you?
Remember the incredible story? I don't know why it's right. Incredible. Exactly. It's incredible what nonsense sticks in your brain, isn't it? All I can remember is seeing a thing once that Benny Hill once spoke to Charlie Chaplin, who said, "Oh, you know, Mr. Hill, you must come with me and you must see my house." And he went to a room in Charlie Chaplin's house, and he had loads of Benny Hill videos. And Benny Hill said he just burst into tears because that was like the greatest thing that could ever be.
Yeah, it was probably because it had lots of young women in it doing women Charlie Chaplin's proclivities.
When we were in St. Ives, not the last time, but maybe the time before, there was nothing on TV at all except Benny Hill. So I put it on because I remembered that my father, who isn't my dad, used to love Benny Hill. And I put it on and I was like, what on earth is this shit? I cannot believe it was on national television.
I did see a Benny Hill clip the other day on Twitter where like some kind of like monster television comes and starts like attacking a child. Like a real like horror movie-esque sort of thing.
Well, that was Russell T. Davis's most recent Doctor Who episode.
Yes, it was, yes.
And also, it's only recently, I know we still have to put up with the bad teeth thing, but you know, for our American cousins listening in, for years, there's Galvatron, for years of listening, whenever you speak to Americans, they'd all go, oh, Britain, bad food, bad teeth, and Benny Hill. And it's like, Benny Hill has not been on TV for decades.
No. It's in the same...
It's incredible how that's got into
block in my DNA, mind is
our country's... Yeah. Ted Rogers.
Okay, so what are we going to give the Stalls of Borchester out of five?
Well, I'll give the Stalls of Borchester.
Oh, whatever, yeah.
I think it's a good 4.5.
4.5 from John.
Yeah.
I've given it a four.
Yes, and I there was so much going on there. There were numerous things that could have spun off into other stories. It didn't creep me out, but it said it really evoked in me those kind of spooky memories. It's got a beautiful feel to it.
Yes.
And it's only nice and short as well. It's only 45 minutes long. It's always welcome.
For me, it's not as good as A Warning to the Curious because it's not the seaside isolated setting that I really like in that. But it is probably the second best one of the Christmas ones because it's really quite flawless. I mean, the special effects and stuff now do look a bit clumsy, but it also doesn't overcook something in the way that other things have done subsequently, you know.
And I think Robert Hardy is amazing.
He's brilliant. He's very good.
Considering a lot of what he's doing, he's not talking.
There's points in
it where you look like he's going to throw up. When he's like getting really sort of like freaked out by things.
The guilt.
You know, the sort of the contempt he's got towards the old man.
Yeah.
And all that kind of, it all comes across in his face. It's incredible. Mm. But I was thinking he's got such a bizarre sort of Shatner-esque delivery of his lines where he puts, he will talk pretty fast and put in breaks in the where you don't expect them where they're going to be, but excellent.
Big friends with Richard Burton as well in real life.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah. Cool.
Brilliant. Well, four out of five from me too. Really enjoyed this one.
So I highly recommend that. Okay, should we say Merry Christmas to everyone and give that stop it there? Or do you want to do it? Because I really need to piss. Oh,
absolutely.
Merry Christmas to everyone.
Okay, so we're going to wait again.
Thank you for listening and have a fantastic Yuletide period.
Yes, well.
Merry Christmas to all of our listener.
Yeah, and I hope that you wake up tomorrow and get some everything you wanted. I hope you get some nice Blu-rays of Hammer horror movies and... And some good horror, and some collected volumes of James Herbert.
I hope novels. That you go and walk in a misty, isolated churchyard, and then there's always a figure of a strange woman in the corner of your eye.
Yeah. And I hope you enjoy shooting tomorrow night with the goblins. And it's absolutely awful. Sonic Screwdriver.
Oh, I haven't seen that.
It looks like a Sky remote. Okay,
but on that bombshell.
But until then, we'll see you on New Year's Eve, everyone. Merry Christmas.
Love, light, and peace.
Bye.
You have been listening to The General Witchfinders. Support the show and continue the conversation at patreon.com/generalwitchfinders. Subscribe and spread the word at generalwitchfinders.com. Farewell, and don't have nightmares.
CV. Mini Clubman. Dubbed Women. Dead Bodies in a Dining Room. Good Cast. Figure on a Beach. Oh, Whistle. The music sounds a bit hooey. Not a Beach. Handheld Camera. Don't Try and Look at My Skirt. Dubbed Voices. Old Cow. Wacky 60s Vibe. Curry and Bates. Dreamlike. Who's in charge? Weird makeup on Bates. Archetype of the English. Cricket match. Carol Drinkwater. Stolen Buckle. Should just tell him to fuck off.
What I might do is just put that out and replace the actual episode of the shout.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.